Ladies and gentlemen, if you'll come in and be seated, and might move more to the front so those who come a little late can have a fine place in the back. We'll begin. My name is Jay Ball, and I'm introducing the folks this afternoon. We are here to learn more of Mormons and Moon Men by Van Hale. Van Hale is a publisher and worker in a partner in Omega Books here locally, has published extensively in BYU Studies, and has studied Mormon history extensively. He has a radio talk show called Mormons Miscellaneous on a Christian radio station called KBBX here out of Centerville, Utah. he will be making the presentation. And the response will be made by James B. Allen, who is chairman of the history department at BYU, a graduate of USU in Logan, a former seminary teacher and former assistant church historian. After these gentlemen have made their thoughts known to us, we will have questions. We will entertain questions from you folks. We'll begin then with Mr. Hale.
The item that you were given, this handout, is a copy of the newspaper Painesville, Ohio Telegraph for September 1835. And it's just quite a delightful little item. I just thought that would be of interest to you. And you'll see perhaps the significance of this as I move along. My paper again is Mormons and Moon Men. For 40 years, diligent staff of the Young Woman's Journal solicited articles, wrote, edited, set type, proofread, promoted subscriptions, kept records, struggled to meet deadlines, and whatever else goes into the publication of a periodical. However, shortly after publication ceased in 1929, their efforts were all but forgotten. It is seldom quoted, no one has yet considered reprinting it. As a generation familiar with the journal was on the verge of extinction, no more than two Mormons in 1,000 under the age of 50 had ever heard of it. But as the final flicker dimmed, an unexpected society came to its rescue and have dedicated themselves to sustaining and reviving memory of the journal. Their efforts have been so successful that not only is knowledge of the journal on the rise among Mormons, but probably more non-Mormons now know of it than ever did during the 40 years of its publication. Published by the Mutual Improvement Association, it was dedicated to promoting faith in the restoration among LDS youth. Thus, it might be expected that some Mormon sympathizers are responsible for this resurgence of interest in the journal. Actually, just the contrary is true. Those determined not to let the journal be forgotten are among those most opposed to the journal's goal, those specifically committed to destroying faith in the restoration. However, their interest is only in a one-page article written in 1892 by Oliver B. Huntington, himself almost forgotten. He wrote, "Astronomers and philosophers have from time almost immemorial until very recently asserted that the moon was uninhabited, that it had no atmosphere, etc. But recent discoveries through the means of powerful telescopes have given scientists a doubt or two upon the old theory. Nearly all the great discoveries of man in the last half century have in one way or another either directly or indirectly contributed to prove Joseph Smith to be a prophet. As far back as 1837, I know that he said the moon was inhabited by men and women the same as this earth, and that they lived to a greater age than we do, that they lived generally near the age of 1,000 years. He described the men as averaging near 6 feet in height and dressing quite uniformly in something near the Quaker style. In my patriarchal blessing, given by the father of Joseph the prophet, in Kirtland, 1837, I was told that I should preach the gospel before I was 21 years of age, that I should preach the gospel to the inhabitants upon the islands of the sea and to the inhabitants of the moon, even the planet you can now behold with your eyes." Many opponents of Mormonism have used Huntington's assertion that Joseph Smith said the moon is inhabited in many tracts, pamphlets, books, and sermons devoted to discrediting Joseph Smith and Mormonism. But then I guess who in the scientific age can blame them? 1,000-year-old moon men in Quaker dress to be evangelized by Mormon elders indeed. And of course they contend that no true prophet could make a mistake of that magnitude. Mormons, on the other hand, feel justified in seeking out Huntington's sources questioning their accuracy or authenticity, and questioning the critics' conclusion, especially considering the low marks these critics must be given in the category of objectivity. The first question, of course, is what were Huntington's sources for his article, his own reminiscence or a second party? He made reference to two separate incidents, a statement of Joseph Smith and his own patriarchal blessing. Most have assumed his source for the Joseph Smith statement was his own memory and have thus questioned its credibility because he was only 11 years old in 1837 and 55 years separated his reminiscence from the event. The value of the statement is further weakened by further examination. Actually, Huntington was not relating his own reminiscence, but someone else's. His immediate source for his article was an 1881 entry in his own personal journal, but that entry is part of a 10-page collection of reminiscences he had acquired from several sources which, as he stated, he had taken some time and pains to pick up. He identified Philo Dibble as his source for the purported Moon Men description of Joseph Smith. This description from Dibble reads as follows. It's entitled Inhabitants of the Moon, and reads, "The inhabitants of the moon are more of a uniform size than the inhabitants of the earth, being about 6 feet in height. They dress very much like the Quaker style and are quite general in style, or the one fashion of dress. They live to be very old, coming generally near 1,000 years. My wife almost insisted that I wear a Quaker suit at this to present this, but she was not able to prevail. Dibble continues, he says, "This is the description of them as given by Joseph the seer, and he could see whatever he asked the Father in the name of Jesus to see. I heard him say he could ask what he would ask of the Father in the name of Jesus, and it would be granted. And I have no more doubt of it than I have that the mob killed him." Dibble's statement adds another point to the issue, his opinion that Joseph Smith's source was revelation. It is obvious, however, that he was only speculating that Joseph Smith's source was divine revelation. Also, the question must be asked, what was Dibble's source? He did not indicate whether it was personal recollection or yet another party, and I have found no further information on this except that Dibble was a collector and had expended considerable effort to collect and produce an exhibit which he presented in several of the Mormon communities. His presentation is most appropriately described as a collection of sensational reminiscences and artifacts pertaining to the life and death of Joseph Smith. It was at one of these presentations in January of 1881 that Huntington acquired Joseph Smith's Moon Men statement from Dibble. So at best, the Moon Men statement is a sensational late third-hand reminiscence and by itself is a very poor source of history. This and one other statement, even less impressive, represent the sum total of testimony that Joseph Smith said that the moon is inhabited. Although it has not been established that he believed in moon men, several close to him did. Joseph Smith's own brother Hiram stated his belief in an inhabited moon in an 1843 sermon on the plurality of gods and worlds preserved in the Journal of George Lobb. Quote, "Every star that we see is a world and is inhabited the same as this world is peopled. The sun and moon is inhabited and the stars. The stars are inhabited the same as this earth." President Brigham Young similarly stated his view on this now famous sermon of July 24, 1870. Who can tell us of the inhabitants of this little planet that shines of an evening called the moon? When we view its face, we may see what is termed the man in the moon and what some philosophers declare are the shadows of mountains. These sayings are very vague and amount to nothing. And when you inquire about the inhabitants of that sphere, you find that the most learned are as ignorant in regard to them as the most ignorant of their fellows. So it is with regard to the inhabitants of the sun. Do you think it is inhabited? I rather think it is. Do you think there is any life there? No question of it. It was not made in vain. It was made to give light to those who dwell upon it and to other planets. Another interesting reference is the blessing Huntington summarized in his Young Woman's Journal article in 1892 and further in a second article for the journal in 1894. In the first, he dated the blessing 1837 and in the second, 1836, and in both he identified Church Patriarch Joseph Smith Sr. as the bestower of the blessing. The following excerpt is undoubtedly from the blessing mentioned by Huntington. It is dated December 7, 1836, at Kirtland, Ohio, but the record clearly records that the blessing was given to Oliver not by Joseph Smith Sr., but by his own father, William Huntington. Quote, "I lay my hands upon thee and bless thee with the Father's blessing. Thou shalt be called to preach the gospel to this generation. Before thou art 21, thou wilt be called to preach the fullness of the gospel. Thou shalt have power with God even to translate thyself to heaven and preach to the inhabitants of the moon or planets, if it shall be expedient." Although there is a discrepancy as to who gave Oliver the blessing, the content and further details given by him support this as being the same blessing mentioned in the Young Woman's Journal. In his 1894 article, he recalled that he received the blessing in 1836 at a blessings meeting for the Huntington family at the home of William Huntington. The meeting was appointed and conducted by Joseph Smith Sr. It lasted the entire day with Orson Pratt recording the blessings the best he could, and afterwards filled up from memory of all present that which he could not catch from the patriarch's lips. It seems unlikely that Oliver, on two different occasions in the same year, would have received the same blessing from two different men. I see several possible explanations of this discrepancy. Since Oliver was only 10 years old at the time and both men apparently were present, perhaps he was mistaken as to who actually performed the blessing. Or perhaps both men participated in giving him the blessing. Or, possibly, although I believe less likely, an error was made in recording the blessing. The blessing was not copied into the Patriarchal Blessings Book for at least 9 years, at which time it was recorded by Albert Carrington along with several other blessings to other members of the Huntington family. More important than accounting for this discrepancy is the very fact that such a blessing, which assumed the existence of Moon Men, was given in the presence of the Patriarch, Apostle Orson Pratt, and the Huntington family and relatives. The Patriarchal Blessings books in the LDS archives are not open for research. Therefore, it is not possible at this time to determine if the idea of preaching to the inhabitants of the moon found in this blessing to Oliver Huntington were common or unique. Today, the idea of an inhabited moon is bizarre enough that some may see blind acceptance of a revelation from Joseph Smith as the most probable explanation of this belief being held among these 19th century Mormons. But one could hardly conclude from these several sources that belief in an inhabited moon was general among Mormons of the 19th century, and further, to conclude that it was a basic position, either of Joseph Smith or of Mormonism would obviously be false. This notwithstanding, critics of Mormonism continue to assert, on the basis of Huntington's statements, that it was claimed that it was by claimed revelation that Joseph Smith described the inhabitants of the moon. In this, they hope to raise the question, as one has queried, can you respect a religious organization that will publish such nonsense? However, the surprising fact is that there have not been found more Mormon declarations of belief in an inhabited moon. This is surprising for two reasons. First, in several of the earliest revelations, in 1830, Moses chapter 1, and in 1832, DNC 76, Mormonism was committed to a belief in many inhabited worlds besides this one. Second, at the birth of Mormonism, belief in an inhabited moon was common even among respected astronomers and clergymen. Although Mormons generally believed in other inhabited worlds, it appears that they seldom resorted to speculating as to which of the heavenly bodies they were. It seems more plausible that Mormons who believed in moon men did so because of the prevalence of that view in their day, rather than that they had accepted as inspired an utterance of Joseph Smith. Various levels of credulity have existed in every age. Today, some believe we are alone in the universe. Some believe there could be other intelligent life. Some believe there definitely is. Some believe we have been contacted by extraterrestrial beings. And some even believe earthlings have been transported to other worlds for a visit. But, and I may regret saying this, nobody today believes in moon men. However, sounds like maybe I'm wrong already. However, in the first half of the 19th century, those at the highest scientific level differed on the question of intelligent life on the moon. In 1822, William Herschel died. He was the greatest astronomer of his time. He discovered the planet Uranus in 1781 and became official astronomer to King George III. In 1976, Patrick Moore, director of the lunar section of the British Astronomical Association, wrote of William Herschel that, As an observer, it is possible that he has never been equaled, and between 1781 and his death in 1822, every honor that the scientific world could bestow came his way. His views about life in the solar system were then rather surprising. He thought it possible that there was a region below the sun's fiery surface where men might live, and he regarded the existence of life on the moon as, quote, an absolute certainty. In 1780, Herschel, in a letter to a disbelieving astronomer, asked, "Who can say that it is not extremely probable, nay, beyond doubt, that there must be inhabitants on the moon of some kind or other?" Also in 1822, the German astronomer Gruithuisen announced that he had discovered a lunar city with a collection of gigantic ramparts extending 23 miles in either direction. It was not until 1838, with the publication of the writings of Beer and Mädler, that the scientific world concluded that the moon is definitely unable to support higher life forms. This, however, had little immediate effect upon popular belief. The scientific conclusion did not become the popular conclusion for at least 60 years. Throughout the era of belief in moon men, for interest and publicity, no year can compare with 1835, the year of the great lunar hoax, perhaps the biggest scientific practical joke of all time. In 1833, the renowned astronomer John Herschel, son of William Herschel, set sail for the Cape of Good Hope to survey the skies of the northern hemisphere as his father had so thoroughly done of the southern hemisphere as his father had so thoroughly done of the northern. He remained there for 5 years until 1838. But in 1835, Richard Locke, a reporter for the New York Sun, decided to take advantage of three facts. First, it was well known that John Herschel was on the other side of the world with a large telescope. Second, interest in the moon was high. Third, communication was slow. So on August 23, 1835, the New York Sun published the first installment of Locke's six-part report under the headline "Great Astronomical Discoveries Lately Made by Sir John Herschel at the Cape of Good Hope." The remaining five installments appeared the following 5 days. The articles were cleverly written and were widely accepted. Locke began by describing in considerable detail the construction and principle of operation of Herschel's new telescope. He reported that John Herschel, by perfecting his father's innovations, and with the financial backing of none other than the King of Britain himself, succeeded in constructing a telescope so powerful that it brought the surface of the moon to the apparent proximity of about 80 yards. The lens was 24 feet in diameter, its weight was 14,826 pounds after being polished, and its magnifying power estimated at 42,000 times. It was an amalgam of two parts crown to one part flint glass, cast with perfect success by Hartley and Grant Dunbarton, January 27, 1833. It was therefore presumed capable of representing objects of 18 inches in diameter with perfect distinctness. Locke explained that, quote, "such profound secrecy has been preserved throughout the whole that the present publication is the first that even the scientific world of Europe have known of this grand system of discoveries." The telescope was finally ready for operation January 10, 1835. After his final adjustments, Herschel made a solemn pause for several hours to prepare his mind to tear away the veil that could make him, for the time, sole depository of the wondrous secrets of that hitherto unseen world. Columbus discovered a continent. He was about to discover a globe. After these preliminaries, Locke proceeded to tell it all, with each installment more wondrous than the preceding, leading to the climax reached in his final installment. In his first glimpse, Sir John saw various rock formations, and then a precipitous shelf covered with a dark red flower, the first organic production of a foreign world ever revealed to the eyes of man. He was then delighted by the sight of a lunar forest. He succeeded in classifying 38 species of forest trees and nearly twice that number of plants. Next, he saw a level green plain and a deep blue lake breaking in large white billows upon a beach of brilliant white sand, but as yet he observed no animal on it. The excitement mounted as the telescope was adjusted to the limit of its magnification, and then the shade of the woods. And then, in the shade of the woods, he beheld continuous herds of brown quadrupeds, having all the external characteristics of the bison, but with one exception, They had a fleshy appendage over the eyes, which was lifted and lowered by means of the ears. There's a good reason for this, however, as he continues. He says that it immediately occurred to the acute mind of Dr. Herschel that this was a providential contrivance to protect the eyes of the animal from the great extremes of light and darkness. Other animals included a gregarious single-horned antelope, engaging in all the unaccountable antics of a young lamb or kitten. On one of the lakes, he saw a variety of water birds plunging their long necks into the lake. He watched for a long time, hoping to catch sight of a lunar fish, but was not gratified. However, the most remarkable animal was the biped beaver, which exactly resembles the beaver, only it had no tail and walks always on its hind legs, carrying its young in its arms. Its huts are higher and better than those of many human savages, and from the appearance of smoke in nearly all of them, it is supposed that the animal is acquainted with fire. Man can no longer be distinguished as the cooking animal. This, of course, was all leading to Locke's climax, the discovery of moon men, which he recounted in his final article, August 28. As he described them, they were winged men who were first observed flying. When their attitude was erect and dignified, their stature was about 4 feet and were covered with short copper-colored hair. They appeared to be constantly engaged in conversing with much impassioned gesticulation, and hence it was inferred that they are rational beings. Others, apparently of a higher order, were discovered afterwards, and finally a magnificent temple for the worship of God of polished sapphire in a triangle shape with a roof of gold. The articles were an immediate sensation and were reprinted in many of the papers. Reverend Harley gave this assessment. When the first number appeared in the New York Sun, the excitement aroused was intense. The paper sold daily by thousands, and when the articles came out as a pamphlet, 20,000 went off at once, not only in young America, but also in old England, France, and throughout Europe. The wildest enthusiasm prevailed. Patrick Moore has further noted that the articles met with a mixed reception, but some eminent critics swallowed the bait, hook, line, and sinker. These new discoveries are both probable and plausible, declared the New York Times, while the New Yorker thought that the observations, quote, had created a new era in astronomy and science generally. The New York Evangelist published a lengthy summary of the articles, which on September 11, 1835, was reprinted in the Painesville, Ohio Telegraph, a paper commonly read in the neighboring Mormon center of Kirtland. And that's, of course, the item that you have. In Massachusetts, a woman's club, wrote to Herschel for his views on how to contact these moon men and convert them to Christianity. One minister told his congregation that on account of the wonderful discoveries of the present age, he lived in expectation of one day calling upon them for a subscription to buy Bibles for the benighted inhabitants of the moon. All of the Sun, on September 16th, confessed their hoax. Their articles only described what many firmly believed existed on the moon, and thus popular belief in an inhabited moon was undaunted in spite of the Sun's confession, which incidentally was not nearly so widely publicized. In fact, the Painesville Telegraph did not even carry the story of the confession. The following year, 1836, the American theologian Dr. Timothy Dwight, in his book Theology, declared that it is most rationally concluded that intelligent beings in great multitudes inhabit the moon's lucid regions, being far better and happier than ourselves. Belief in intelligent moon life continued for many years. The last great advocate of relatively advanced life on the moon was W.H. Pickering, author of the 1904 photographic atlas, as well as many papers about all branches of lunar study. Perhaps the most valuable point in all this is that the credibility of figures of one generation cannot be judged fairly by the standard of a later generation. It may be that today a person's credibility should be questioned if he believes in a moon civilization in need of evangelizing, but to deny credibility to those of the last century who believe this is an unjustifiable mistake. The question does still remain, did Joseph Smith believe in an inhabited moon? From the examination of the historical evidence now available, the answer must be not proven. But all things considered, the possibility or probability that he did cannot reasonably be denied. For all others of that era, the question seems quite insignificant, especially when the popular and scientific beliefs of the 19th century are considered. But in the case of Joseph Smith, he claimed to be a prophet, and some extremists contend that by so claiming, his knowledge in every area must be superior to those of his era, asserting that if it were proven that he believed in any false notion of his day, his credibility must be doubted. This position, however, is rejected by many, both LDS and non-LDS Christian, who are more familiar not only with the teachings of the prophets, but also with the beliefs current in their day. Many prominent Christian Bible scholars concur with Reverend J.R. Dumelow's conclusions in his widely received one-volume Bible commentary. He stated that, quote, in the Bible the divine and human are blended, and that the authors are, though purified and ennobled by the influence of his Holy Spirit, men, each with his own peculiarities of manner and disposition, each with his own education or want of education, each with his own way of looking at things, each influenced differently from another by the different experiences and discipline of his life, their inspiration did not involve a suspension of their natural faculties. It did not even make them free from earthly passion. It did not make them into machines. It left them men. Therefore, we find their knowledge sometimes no higher than that of their contemporaries. Of the author of Genesis, Dumelow wrote, his scientific knowledge may be bounded by the horizon of the age in which he lived, but the religious truths he teaches are irrefutable and eternal. In conclusion, I suppose the situation remains unchanged. Certainly some critics will persist in their belief that Oliver B. Huntington's 1892 article has devastated both Joseph Smith and Mormonism. Some determined Mormons will dogmatically deny to the end that Joseph Smith ever for a moment believed in moon men, while I suspect that ardent fundamentalists will yet testify fervently that when men really do land on the moon, they will be greeted by an elderly Quaker-like gentleman proving empirically the divine inspiration of the prophet Joseph Smith.
This is the second year in a row that I've had the privilege of commenting on Van's papers at the Sunstone Symposium. I hope he isn't getting tired of it. I'm surely not, if the papers continue to be as interesting and as worthwhile as this paper. First, then, let me congratulate Mr. Hale on his usual thorough job of tracing down the sources on specialized aspects of Mormon history. I'm ashamed to admit that even though I tried to do a bit of my own sleuthing on this topic several years ago, I've searched in vain for the notes I made at the time. But as near as I can remember, Van, I found nothing then about Joseph Smith and the Moon Man that Mr. Hale has not incorporated into this paper. He's right, so far as I can tell. There is really no clear contemporary evidence that Joseph Smith taught or believed in the idea of moon men, even though I would probably go a little further than Van in believing that the circumstantial evidence is strong enough to suggest that there's a much better than 50% chance that Joseph Smith did believe. I have little quarrel, then, with Mr. Hale's research and presentation. In fact, I concur practically 100% with everything he said, except one thing, which will be clear at the end of the talk. But his paper has some interesting implications, at least for me, and raises some interesting questions that I think are appropriate to explore a bit more in depth, especially in a forum such as the Theological Symposium. One is, what difference does it make? And the answer to that, of course, depends on one's special interest or bias, and it is this that I would like to comment on for a few moments, the impact of our biases upon what we believe that others believe. Van has pointed out that one reason certain anti-Mormons have resurrected the old Young Women's Journal is to try to persuade Mormons that because Joseph Smith said there were men on the moon, he must be a false prophet, and therefore that Mormonism is indeed false. But assume that Joseph Smith did believe in moon men, and my biases lead me to believe that he did. One thing that bothers me is why the anti-Mormon naysayers believe that mature, rational Mormons can't accept the possibility, even the probability, that their prophets have often said things that have later proved to be incorrect. Oh, I recognize, of course, that the anti-Mormons use this tiny piece of information only as one more piece in a mountain of data that, in the aggregate, is supposed to prove that Joseph was a deceiver and that the church is false. And when the debunkers themselves sincerely believe this, then it's understandable that every mistake made by any prominent Mormon will simply confirm this in their own minds, and they will have a difficult time understanding why other honest people can't see it their way. But now my own biases as a believing Mormon who is also a historian comes out. I confess that I worry sometimes about the nature of the faith of those Mormons who listen to and read all the mistakes and judgment of their leaders and suddenly find themselves to be on the verge of apostasy. I ask myself, what is the basis of their faith? Is it based on some mythological or idyllic concept that in some strange way Mormon prophets are immune from human error? And of course, this is what Van implies too. Such faith, it seems to me, is of course easily torn to shreds if too many such errors are thrown at that kind of believer. But I have the hope, naive some people might say, that most Mormons are mature and rational enough to recognize that even church leaders, including Joseph Smith and his successors, are human, and that neither God nor his prophets have ever claimed that they were above making mistakes. Let me go just a bit further with that, and then I'll get off my favorite soapbox. As a believing historian, my professional training compels me to feel some deep concern for my students in terms of some of the impressions that they may be receiving. As I have studied all that has been written about Joseph Smith just among the Mormons, I find a myriad of miscellaneous, sometimes even misleading, or erroneous images being created. I'm almost as concerned about this as I am about the penchant of others to debunk, for I think it could create some unrealistic expectations in my students and in the long run set them up to be hurt. I'm reminded that during the lifetime of Joseph Smith, he continually protested the tendency in some of his disciples to expect too much, or for outsiders to look for too much. One thing I like about Joseph Smith is the fact that when I encounter him, I find a man who recognized his own human frailties, was candid about them, and was trying to overcome them. This morning, his history reports in 1843, February 8th, I read German and visited with a brother and sister from Michigan who thought that a prophet is always a prophet. We've all heard this, haven't we? But I told them that a prophet was a prophet only when he was acting as such. In a Sunday sermon in July 1843, he said, "It's gone abroad that I proclaim myself no longer a prophet. I said it last Sabbath, ironically. I supposed you would all understand. It was not that I would renounce the idea of being a prophet, but that I had no disposition to proclaim myself such. The burdens which roll upon me are very great. My persecutors allow me no rest, and I find that in the midst of business and care, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Although I was called of my heavenly Father to lay the foundation for this great work and kingdom in this dispensation, I am subject to the like passions as other men, like the prophets of old." His closest friends even heard him say that some revelations are of God, some revelations are of man, and some revelations of the devil. Now, I'm not one to go about making long lists of all the prophets' errors. I know many of them, but our friends, the debunkers, are capable enough of publicizing them. But I do think it's important for faithful Mormons at least to accept the principle that Joseph Smith was trying to put across. That is, that it is possible for a prophet to say something that was not given to him by revelation, and that if such things led to giving out mistaken information, that does not prove that other information was not given by revelation, or that the prophet was not a prophet. This thought, it seems to me, has special application for today, as we hear so much talk about changing doctrinal perceptions, the Adam-God theory, the change in the doctrine of the priesthood, and many other changing concepts. If Mormons would only accept the rather anti-creedal attitude of Joseph Smith, and as Van pointed out, Joseph Smith never made this a matter of dogma, neither did anybody else, as well as what he tried to teach the saints of his day about himself and the nature of prophets generally, then they would have little trouble with the mounting public affirmations coming from a variety of sources that he was indeed really a human being. It is only an uncritical acceptance of the mythology that has been built about him since his death that leads us into difficulty. But let me turn now to a few other thoughts that Van Hale's paper forced into my mind. Van has told us that not only that Joseph Smith may have believed in moon men, but also that many of his contemporaries, both in and out of the church, believed the same thing. I've seen no evidence that anyone else suggested that they dressed like Quakers, but there is abundant evidence that even very late in the 19th century, this was common belief, especially among certain religionists in the world. Van, in fact, cites in his paper Timothy Harley's book entitled Moon Lore, written in 1885, as evidence of the scientific conclusions of 1838 against moon men did not become the popular belief for 60 years. This isn't precisely the way that Harley states it, but it's interesting that this writer, an English divine, spent an entire chapter in his book examining all the scientific and logical evidence at his disposal. By this time, the scientific world was having a definite impact on religious thought, and Harley very gingerly threaded his way through all the evidence in order to show that he was not anti-scientific or that he was not dogmatic in his assumptions. And he stated his conclusions firmly, though with a clear pronouncement that he realized that science may yet prove him wrong. And what were these conclusions? Quote, "We cannot admit the probability that the earth is the only tenement with tenants. We must be confirmed in our judgment that the sun and the planets with their moons, ours of course included, are neither blank nor barren, but abodes of variously organized beings fitted to fulfill the chief end of all noble existence, the enjoyment of life, the effluence of love, the goal of the good of all around, and the glory of God above." In other words, his religious perceptions let him accept the evidence on the side of moon men. The point I want to make of this, so far as the history of Mormon thought is concerned, is that Mormons were not so different from other people, not only in this, but in many of their religious perceptions. While it's true that by the end of the Nauvoo period there were many unique doctrines in Mormonism, and that the whole body of teachings as they had developed by that time certainly presented a unique doctrinal package, many elements of that body had their counterpart in society. This is not to say that Joseph Smith deliberately copied from anyone, but the evidence is abundant that at least some of his ideas were very much in the air. But why should this surprise or bother anyone, especially with regard to Moonmen? Great thinkers from Pythagoras to Jules Verne, and even more recent than him, have suggested the notion of Moonmen, so why not Joseph Smith? Certainly neither he nor Brigham Young made no creedal irreversible issue of it, nor did they place it in the category of absolutes for Mormon doctrine. But if they picked up what was in the air, who was to blame them? All this should do is make Mormon scholars and theologians especially careful as they try to define what came by revelation, what was essential to the Mormon faith, and what elements in that whole body of private and pulpit, pronouncements were personal views or speculations that could have come from a variety of sources. And it's healthy, I believe, for historians to look at all the possible sources for Mormon thought, not with the idea of defining them environmentally, but simply for increasing our understanding of how they were related to the intellectual world around them, and possibly we might even understand them better. Another thought that comes from all this is that Mormons need to be more aware of the history of the doctrines of their church. One of the great contributions, I believe, of symposia such as this, and I certainly give Peggy Fletcher and her Sunstone colleagues great credit for the boldness with which they have promoted these things, is that they are helping to open our minds to the realization that Mormonism is not and never has been a static faith. Some of us may find some of our pet ideas or biases a little wrenched with the discovery of some new things about the history of our faith, but I think it's far better to know what has happened and rationalize our faith accordingly than to live our lives in ignorance and suddenly have our faith destroyed by some sudden shaking of a rather sandy foundation. But I could go on too long this way. My only reason for mentioning this here is that Vann's paper is in part an interesting and worthwhile element in the much larger picture we will one day have of all the changing aspects of Mormon thought. Vann's paper also makes me want to comment on the role of the moon as well as other heavenly orbs in Mormon thought. But alas, I know the time is running out. Suffice it to say that just as the Reverend Harley had a theological base for his perception of an inhabited moon, so Mormons, who have commented on extraterrestrial inhabitants, have seen this as a part of their faith that all the worlds were created by God for the purpose of promoting the well-being of his spiritual offspring. As Vann has said, it is no new thing to Mormons to believe that there is life beyond this earth, and perhaps an important paper for another Sunstone symposium would be one dealing with the extraterrestrial worlds in Mormon thought. Now let's argue about who's going to write that. The paper would consider various controversies and points of view, including Joseph Fielding Smith's well-known predictions that man would never reach the moon, for according to his gospel perception, man was destined to work out his salvation on this earth alone. But that is something we can only look forward to seeing fully discussed another time. But now let me conclude with a brief observation on a couple of statements made by Mr. Hale. I should chide him a little for his statement on page 1 that in the heyday of the Young Women's Journal, no more than 2 Mormons in 1,000 under the age of 50 ever heard of it. I would be interested in the objective database for that conclusion. At the same time, he says that today no more Mormons know of it than ever did while it was being published, and this, I suspect, is only because there are more non-Mormons now than there were then, but again, no database. Now, all of this suggests that if these things are the only problems I can find with his research, I'm getting pretty picky. But I must conclude with a rather disturbing statement that he makes on page 6. Nobody, he says, believes in moon men. As an avid fan of Dick Tracy, Vann, I'm stunned. For I am suddenly confronted with my own tragic reassessment of another great American hero. In 1968, Dick Tracy and Diet Smith landed on the moon. I know, because I read it in the papers. There they found a great subsurface culture, intelligent people with little antennas sticking out from their heads. In 1969, other Americans landed on the moon. I know that because I read that in the papers, too. But they found no moon men, and neither did their successors. But Chester Gould, the writer of Dick Tracy, persisted. Tracy brought back a girl from the moon, and Junior Tracy even married her, and they had offspring. But alas for our final evidence of our last great hope for life on the moon. Since that time, even Dick Tracy seems to have reneged. The moon maid died. Her child has disappeared from the comic strip, and Junior Tracy has even married Sparkle Plenty. It is as if the moon maid and her race had never existed. And perhaps Dick Tracy never really went to the moon in the first place. But Van, you can't destroy my faith by saying no one believes in moon men. For someday I will resurrect the old Dick Tracy strips, and then, despite the ignorance of the present writers of Dick Tracy, my own latent faith in moon men will be revived, at least for a little while. So there.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Now we'd like to entertain your questions and have you direct them to the appropriate presenter.
Well, I imagine that if you're taking the position that when a prophet is speaking as a prophet, I suppose most people would conclude that then is the truth. What he says is the truth. And, from my own personal perception, to outline some way of saying this is how you determine what an individual said is true or false when you're talking about Mormon prophets, I just don't know. I have not yet seen any clear-cut way of doing that, except for those who just take the position that every word that he speaks is the word of God and is the truth. And there are, of course, a few of those, many of those left. I don't know. To me, from history, it's a difficult thing. You have to look at each issue. You have to look at each statement, I suppose, and try to bring together all the information, and perhaps hope that maybe an angelic visit will answer the question. I don't know. Jim, you answer it.
Of course, that I think is a question that's been going around in church education circles for longer than I can ever remember. And I don't think there's an absolute answer. I agree pretty generally with what Van said. I suppose, though, that we do have to recognize a lot of this has to be individual. And just in terms of speaking strictly from the standpoint of faith, I have to refer you back to a talk that J. Reuben Clark gave back in 1954, which most of you are familiar with, When Can Words of the Leaders of the Church Be Accepted as Scripture? And what he does, and I suppose this is the hardest answer of all, is say it goes right back to you. If they're speaking and they're inspired by the Holy Ghost, you can never know it for sure unless you're inspired by the Holy Ghost the same way. Now that doesn't answer it in any objective way, but I think what it suggests is that there probably are a lot of areas that will always be somewhat ambiguous. I think one of the signs of maturity, and I'm not sure I've reached that point, but one of the signs of maturity in a system like ours is the ability to learn to live at least with some ambiguity, learn to live with the idea that you don't have to have all the answers. And for myself, I've tried to define, and I don't want to go into detail on this, there isn't time, but try to define what I consider to be kind of my own essentials that are the rock that keep me to the church, that include several things that I think are pretty reasonably unchanging in the church. Other things, I have to look at it very much like Van did. That's about all I can say on it. You're calling.
Well, the of course, the difficulty with that statement is the same. You have the same difficulty with that as you have with the moon men statement, and that is that you have coming through, at best second or third or fourth hand accounts. And I don't know how you deal with that. There is nothing that I'm aware of contemporary with Joseph Smith on that point. I think if that were a common belief that he held or something that he stated on numerous occasions, there would be better evidence for it. But again, I don't know that it would directly apply to this idea of moon men, but because we do have the fact that Joseph Smith firmly believes, I think well established, that there is life on numerous other planets, numerous other places. Of course, the 10 tribes is getting into a little bit different sort of a thing, but so I don't know that it really exactly applies. Is that just a statement or a question? I would think that the obviously what you're the point that you're making does direct itself to a much more significant matter than the Moon Men issue. However, on the other hand, there is a similar sort of situation in that today, you know, this sort of thing seems incredible to us, whereas at that time it was not an incredible sort of a thing. I mean, not to the degree that we would view it today. I think the issue of how Joseph Smith produced the Book of Mormon is one of the primary issues that we're going to be looking at for some time in the future, and at least from my way of thinking, how he produced it has not yet been adequately defined.